We had a very special fireside chat on living the cookieless life as marketers using creators. We got real about the hot topic out there right now, a cookieless existence for us marketers. Now, we spent our time focused on how creators can be one of the most effective ways to drive traffic to your website, engage in meaningful connections with your customers, and live a cookieless life. Implementing or even doubling down on creators doesn't mean putting all of your eggs in this basket. It means being more strategic. How can you work smarter, not harder, with what you have? And how can you test new things to find new ways to maximize what you're already doing well? Put your AirPods in, turn up that volume, and get ready for a little influencer marketing Q&A with our influencer strategists, Rebecca, Kristen, and Rachel. Welcome back, ladies. Excited to have you on the audio version of the unanswered questions that we did not get to. I believe that I've sent you all of the questions, but we will dive right into it. Any interesting insights on the intersection between influencer marketing and the upcoming technologies around AR, VR, metaverse?
Whoa, that's a fun one. I am honestly not very sure. Are we talking like virtual influencers? Is that a thing?
I would say that we should talk about virtual influencers. There's a lot of articles that have come out recently as well too. And I know that we wrote a blog as well about the virtual as well too. But any thoughts or insights on that intersection between influencer marketing and like that virtual technology?
I think something to keep in mind is always say yes. Like, it doesn't hurt to learn more, test, and try. I know there were a lot of memes going around about Meta and the metaverse, but it is here to stay. So rather than say no and push it away, I would say we should embrace it and just go about it with curiosity, like trying to learn more. I myself will probably do some research after this to get up to date. But yeah, I think I'm excited by it.
I think there's opportunity in really everything. So to your point, like definitely test it out because you never know, especially I think because we are living in such a remote world now more than ever, even with like things opening back up, there are a lot of just companies and brands that are staying remote. So we're reinventing and rethinking the way that we advertise, that we market in general. So it makes sense that influencer marketing would be part of that conversation as well too. What do you consider a nano versus a macro influencer? Is there a threshold of followers or other metric that you use to classify each tier?
I think this is such a subjective question as well. It really depends. I would say nano is like really anyone over like 1,000 to maybe like 15,000, 20,000. Macro, at this point, I would say is anyone over like 500,000, but I'm sure each of us could answer this so differently. So just think nano, very small, very, very small following. I think too, it also depends on their willingness and ability to accept product for payment. I think once they're not willing is when I would kind of classify them more micro or even mid-tier. So it might not even necessarily be following related, but you know, engagement related or audience related is maybe a better way to determine who's nano versus macro.
That's an interesting thought. I like that as well too.
Yeah, I think we all kind of define that a little bit differently. And that is something whenever I'm talking to brands, like I try to make sure I define how I use those terms because it does change brand over brand. So I think the most important thing is that you are aligned internally when you're talking to your team on how you differentiate the two.
Agree. I do like, you know, Kristen's thought of it's not just like the followers is, will they accept product gifting as well too? I think in my head, I always think of nano as anything below the swipe up and then micro is anything above that. And then like the true big paid partnerships as like the macro. But I think it's very telling that all four of us have very different definitions. So I would also lean on what you said, Rebecca, as well, too, when you're
when you're speaking to any brand and you are the brand yourself, make sure that you guys have defined that internally. I cannot stress the importance of semantics in general, because I know that, like, even within my own marketing team, like, I'll be talking about one thing and they'll be talking about the one thing, and we think we're saying the same thing, and it turns out we don't. So we all have it. There's no real universal language. We just have to create it. They're universal words. All right. So our brand is just getting started on Grin. Fantastic. I love to hear that. We are gifting product as part of the onboarding and building relationships with creators. But listening today makes me curious. When do you think it's ideal time to gift product through the course of the relationship, at the start or further down the road?
I like to gift product as soon as you can. That's going to be the driving force in really getting that relationship started. There's a trust that has to be built. And in order for them to really believe that this is going to be beneficial to them, they need to see that you're willing to put in your part. And the portion that is your part is the delivery of product. So that's, you make that first effort, deliver the product, and then they'll deliver the content. I think that that still means that prior to getting the content, the product to them, prior to them receiving it, you still should be talking to them during, like, if the package is out for delivery, you can email them and just say, hey, I noticed that your package is out for delivery. If you haven't received your tracking information yet, here it is. Just touch base and keep that dialogue open, but still making sure that that product is getting out ASAP.
I would say that even if you're focused on more paid, like, macro partnerships, what I did to kind of start that relationship is gifting product right away. Sometimes the contract negotiation phase takes a while. It could take a month. So priming them with your product so that they're maybe more inclined to post organically is a tactic that I heavily use, of like, we love you. We want you to start, you know, having our product on hand. And they were actually really excited about that and made them even more excited to post the actual sponsored content. So as soon as possible, I would suggest.
I tend to agree there as well too. Rachel, some additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, I love that. And going off of that, I think, you know, at the core of this is really about the testimonial and that authentic review or use of the product. But in order to have that, you have to test it out. So I would say give the influencers, you know, up to a month to have the experience with that product. So in the case of fashion, it's, you know, wearing it on a daily basis. In food, it's maybe trying it out, you know, after school, or potentially like in a moment of when you need, you know, a little boost of energy. So having that experience with the product is when I've seen the best performing content. But in order to have that, you have to let them try it, which is you know, about a month.
Yeah, I think holding the cards too close to you, like, I'm not going to give you this product until we've signed the deal, is not a great way to even start a relationship, right? It's not starting a relationship of trust. I would say whether your campaign is that of just product gifting in general, it is just a great way to introduce your brand. It's a great way to introduce goodwill and start a relationship off right. Who doesn't like free stuff? I would imagine celebrities even do like free stuff as well, too. Mind you, they can all purchase it, but I like, it's nice to get something for free and to have someone gift it to you as well. Like, hey, I thought that you would like this. There it's an instant connection with someone. So I love that.
And if you can gift heavily, I know some of these smaller brands, you know, budgets are really tight, but if you have the option to maybe provide a couple of products or the ability of choice or full size, I think that goes a long way. Yeah. I think you'll get greater return if you're willing to give more upfront. So potentially gifting a little heavily or a repeat gift or restock can be really beneficial.
Absolutely. Can you give some insight into a formal agreement between a small business and a micro influencer? Terms, signing expectations. While we don't want to get into the legalities, I would say any advice that you can give in regards to things that you know that you want to ensure that make that agreement between a creator and a brand.
So I would say the first thing that you're going to want to do before you even send the contract over is you're going to want to give them kind of a breakdown on what the requirements are that you're expecting of them that they're going to be seeing in the contract. I don't recommend sending them a 6 to 10 page document and expecting them to really don't expect them to really read it all. I think we've all kind of made the mistake of, like, you know, scrolling down and just clicking I agree and moving on. So laying out what, like, their portion of, like, what is expected of them, because there's a lot in the contract that's going to be you covering your brand. But the portion of the contract that is outlining their expectations or your expectations of them, you should let them know that ahead of time. I recommend giving some guidelines to what the content is that you're expecting. If you have any posting requirements, tag requirements, things like that, listing all of that out as clearly as you can. And it should look exactly the same in the email prior to sending the contract over as it does in the contract. You don't want to be mixing up the words or changing things up when the contract gets sent over. So making sure that that's all clear and planned out ahead of time is going to be really important. I would say you want to be, if you are paying them, making sure that, like, any budget that you're paying them is also very clear in the contract. But for the most part, your legal counsel should handle most of the contract. You should pretty much have control of, like, one page of it maybe. And that would be where you're going to include your guidelines and your deliverables and things like that. But like I said, just be as clear as possible and let them know ahead of time what they're going to be seeing before they receive that document.
Great answer. Chris and Rachel, do you want to add anything to it?
I would say what was really helpful for our, like, micro product seeding partnerships is having a template contract and really not budging with micros and kind of creating any red lines. It was kind of like, this is it. This is what you have to sign, or not even assign, but just agree to. It doesn't need to be as formal. But again, don't want to provide any legal advice here. I am not I'm not an attorney, but that helped us a lot to streamline the quick pace micro partnerships that, you know, just wanted to kind of flash the terms and go from there.
I think the key takeaway too is, like, you should have terms, like, have that in mind. Make sure that there is no, I think that where brands get into trouble is if they don't say anything at all, right? Like, and to your point, Kristen, like, have a template and don't budge. Like, and Rebecca, adding those very clear terms, make sure that there's no gray space. Like, if you want to repurpose the content, then make sure that that's in the contract so that you don't get yourself into any, you know, sort of hot water. And again, we're not giving any legal advice. Just letting everybody who's listening know that. All right, next question. How does the likes of RewardStyle and other affiliate marketing partners come into play with influencer marketing? Now that Instagram allows for affiliate links to be used as stickers in stories, for example. So how does the likes of RewardStyle and other affiliate marketing partners come into play with influencer marketing? And ironically, this goes into, like, the semantics that we were talking about before. Like, so many people have a different definition of affiliates. So maybe let's start there. When you say affiliates, Rachel, what do you typically mean when you're talking about affiliates?
I love that. So when I talk about affiliates, I think of kickback commission. So that, I think, is the key determining factor, or having a link where you're able to, again, see those commissionable sales. So that's my definition of affiliate. I'm curious what Kristen, yours is, as well as Rebecca's.
Totally agree. That kickback commission, and also just, like, very transactional, right? Not, you know, building and nurturing these long-term authentic relationships. So I think RewardStyle is amazing. I think it serves its own purpose, and very helpful for the influencer, the brand, and the end user and audience. But I always gravitated more toward, even with these more affiliate commission structured partnerships, to be all, you know, within our current influencer program. I actually never really did work with RewardStyle or Like to Know It, just because I wanted to be more hands on and really have more, you know, a touch point to those conversions rather than going through a third party. So all in all, I think it serves its purpose, but I was really more excited about building those more long-term, you know, nurturing partnerships rather than the kickback transactional ones.
Yeah, I agree. Rebecca, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I agree on the definition of affiliate with Kristen and Rachel. But I do think there is a benefit to using them, especially for maybe smaller brands that don't have a budget and are running into roadblocks with purely gifting influencers. the influencer space has been getting more and more expensive over the past couple of months even. And they are expecting some sort of an incentive back, and that affiliate program can really provide some sort of payment to the influencer in a way that doesn't necessarily tap into the company's budget as much.
Yeah. And I also think that when it comes down to it, the advantage of affiliate links is that there's a bit of attribution that goes along with it, right? It's going to help with your reporting in general. I love that it is being opened up. I recently spoke with someone who's like, oh my God, I feel so strongly against like removing of the swipe up. But I think that as someone who is managing an influencer marketing program, it opens up your options as to who it is that you can use, where traditionally you're using like those people that could only do it if they had 10K, right? Like now your budget's opened up to be able to use the links in whichever way you want to, like those influencers that are more engaged, right? Like that are like more of those nanos that you know are gonna, you know, give you more of that bottom of funnel, which I hate to say that, but like, you know, but they are gonna deliver like those sales, those revenues, the conversions for you as well too. All right, next, what are your thoughts on engaging more with platform native services such as Google Shop, Facebook Marketplace in order to drive more accuracy on platform audience insights? So what are your thoughts on engaging more with platform native services? I love the Google Shopping idea as well too. I think that you can definitely leverage and repurpose your content for Google Shopping as well too. Lifestyle images work really well. And Facebook Marketplace, that would be an interesting place. But what are your thoughts on engaging more with those kind of native services?
I'm all for leaning into different avenues.
It's definitely worth testing because I think those native integrations make it easier to shop. So if you're really trying to hone in on those conversions, like why not test something that could potentially make that ease of transaction even better for the audience?
And I think also meeting consumers where they are, like where they're at shopping wise and where they're, you know, spending a lot of their time and energy and effort online is valuable.
Love that. Now, as a brand, is it good or ethical to have a list of incredible top tier and blacklisted influencers to share information with other brands? That's an interesting question. So as a brand, would you recommend having lists of those go-to influencers that you want to work with, or even like a blacklist, you're not going to want to work with this influencer? I know that in having recently spoken to a lot of talent agents for creators, they have their own list that they will share out and say like, hey, this creator is really difficult to work with. They are A, B, C, or D. So I think that's interesting. That's an interesting question. I don't know if you guys have some thoughts on like having the go-to list and maybe even sharing them out. Do you hold close those high-performing influencers so that they don't work with other brands? Do you want to share it? Rachel, thoughts? She's nodding no. She's nodding no.
In terms of the high performers, yes, I did keep them pretty close to my heart. I don't know if I would recommend that, but I think, you know, the people that on the other, the flip side, the blacklisted ones, I think that's one, it's okay to do that if someone isn't working well for your brand, or maybe you had an unwell encounter with them. So yeah. I think that's totally okay. And I would say, you know, influencer marketing, there's more than enough to share around. And so it's not a bad thing to share those top performers and those successes with your peers.
Yeah, I think it's also important to remember, like, everyone has bad days, you know, sometimes like a creator might not work well with your brand, but could be a completely different experience at another brand. So I never like really shared, you know, cross industries or other brands, because I think everyone deserves benefit of the doubt. And I think what was more of something I shared is with agencies, or, you know, sharing other agencies that might be, you know, not portraying their creators as best as they should, or I think that's more valuable than the creator itself, just to protect, right, the creators. They're helping us brands, and we want them to feel like we're supporting them, even if it's not the greatest of partnership.
I think it goes down to it's a relationship. Right? Like I would want the heads up if someone's difficult to work with. And then you guys as my friends, I'd say like, hey, Rebecca, this person was a real challenge. I mean, all for it, but here's what my challenge was. And because these were my demands, because I do think you, to your point, Kristen, like, you know, give people the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they just weren't my jam, but totally Rebecca's jam. And they like completely click because you never know. But I had interrupted you, Rebecca. What were you going to say in regards to sharing?
Yeah, I don't think it's bad to have a list of those top performers or the blacklisted people, but I'm with Rachel. I would be hesitant to share it across other companies or other people. Like if it's one thing to like for your team, your internal team to know that. But I would be hesitant to kind of share horror stories, I guess, with people across industries, just because it is a small industry and you never know who someone else knows. And you don't want to tarnish their relationship with someone else just because you had a bad relationship with a friend of theirs or one of maybe their colleague or something like that. So I try to keep every relationship that I've had with my influencers kind of personal and try and keep it as private as possible. I don't know if it's an ethical issue. It just might be a personal preference on my end.
No, I'd agree with that. I also think that when it comes to kind of your top performers, it's not going to be a secret. As a brand, you can see other brands who are leveraging specific creators and the frequency of that as well, too. That's the social listening part that I really like about Grin as well, too, is that you can follow your competitors. Like, all right, who are they working with? How often are they working with? And then you can see the quality of it as well, too. So there's almost no need to really share a list of any kind in general. But I love and appreciate each one of your perspectives on that as well, too. Have you guys had experience with whitelisting for content creators?
I definitely have. all of the programs I worked on, that was a main pillar of our program. Was obviously the organic posting, but then taking that content and driving dark ads, putting, you know, paid spend behind the influencers' handles and amplifying and tapping into their audience was our bread and butter. Maybe not so much anymore with the iOS update or cookie-less world we're living in now, but I think it is a very... It's like a two-prong approach. Think about them in separate ways. But I think a really good tell of how they're going to perform with the whitelisting strategy is how they're performing organically.
Yeah.
So while we always built in whitelisting into our agreements with partners, it wasn't guaranteed that we were going to amplify it, you know, the same across all of our partners. We wanted to kind of get a feel for how it performed organically, how it's performed in the past. And then, you know, move into our strategic approach for whitelisting.
I like having it built in so that you have the option to, but not the obligation, right?
Yes.
I imagine that it's going to make some things a little bit easier.
And it's expensive. Influencers are only getting more savvy when it comes to whitelisting and paid media. They know that that you want to use their content in that space. So building it in upfront will help the rate overall, because they might negotiate higher amount if you ask for it after, you know, they go live.
Absolutely. I would also think that there's a bit of an advantage to asking for the whitelist on the front end. It shows that you're thinking long term, not short term. And in the conversations I've had, like, that does affect, you know, whether an influencer says yes or no. Like if you're just going to use them for a one-off, then they're going to ask for everything.
And I think it goes back to that trust, because I don't think it's as common in the creator world. I think it's not, whitelisting isn't as known of a term in the creator world. So I think being upfront really establishes that trust, and also maybe tells them like, hey, you could, you know, ask this from other brands as well. So I think it's all about, you know, establishing that trust with them.
Yeah, totally agree on like whitelisting. I mean, while they understand you might want to use their content in paid ads, whitelisting, dark ads, dark posts, like all these terminology, like it gets very confusing. So being very clear and using like layman terms with influencers in that upfront conversation, I think is super important. They don't care what it's called. They just want to understand how you're using it and how they might see their you know, handle pop up in a sponsored ad.
Yeah. I love that. What are the best platforms out there to find creators and influencers? I'm going to take that one and just say Grin, because we're all grinners. Grin is the tool that you're going to want to use to find influencers, because we have a very robust recruitment suite, search engine, so you can find what competitors are doing, as well as who your top influential customers are, to be able to leverage that. We've got lookalike features, and then you can also search on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube as well, too, to find the right creators. So I'm going to answer for us, because I think that we can all agree. We're also not an opt-in network, which I think is really key. I don't know if you guys have ever worked with opt-in networks as well, too. It's great because you get the fast yes, but also you're working with whoever everybody else is working with as well, too. And it's much less authentic. So how do you approach influencers in terms of money? They put this in quotes, which I really appreciate. Do they state their price, or do you go in with a budget? What's your advice on this?
I think something, and maybe my tip for brands, is knowing, you know, your total budget and how much you could probably spend on each creator. Because I think as soon as your first question is, send me your rate card or your media kit, you're not taking any of the power. So I would recommend for brands just starting out to kind of have an idea of what you can afford per influencer. Yeah. And I think that the great part about influencer is it's a negotiation. It's not like a billboard where it's a set price. So I think there oftentimes can be some give and take, you know, depending on the other perks, but it really is meant to be kind of a flow that works best for both parties.
I think that's going to kind of be out of your control sometimes. Sometimes when you reach out to the influencer, they're just going to come at you with their rates. They're just going to say, I would love to work with you. Here are my rates. And so you don't really have the chance to like start off the conversation with an offer. But my personal preference is, whenever possible, I like to come with an offer first, because I find that if an influencer is coming into the conversation going at the high side of their rates, if you come in at the low side, sometimes there is no middle ground. So if you kind of coming out at the low side right away offers less chance of offending them.
I think the offending part is really, like, we should spend some time there, because I think you want to put your best foot forward. And also cancel culture is real. So being able to you represent the brand and through this negotiation. So I think that's really important to keep in mind. And thank you for bringing that up, Rebecca.
And if we're going to lean into the offending the influencer, I think it's key that there is a very high chance that you're going to be talking to influencers who you just can't afford their rates you just can't afford their rates. And so leaving the conversation on a good note is going to be important. You can still be respectful. You know, they come in and they say their rates and there's just no negotiation there. You can say, unfortunately, that's out of our budget at this time, but we will reach out in the future if something else, if the budget increases or something else comes up, like looking forward to hopefully working with you at a later time. Keeping that door open, being respectful of their rates. I wouldn't ever like knock their rate down and say like, absolutely not, I don't know what you're thinking or something like that. Like, just be respectful and let the door close nicely.
I will say too, there's tactics in approaching the negotiation, which I know that's not your question, but I think it's important to mention that a lot of times influencers will just be like, hey, here's my rates. And it's broken down by like post, story slides, usage, etc. And they often price it out kind of a la carte, but I would always approach it as like, this is a partnership. We kind of want to like create a bundled deal, so to say. So I think even if they come at you really strong with like, here's my rates, it kind of feels a little like non-negotiable. There's always ways to, you know, work with them and find what works for both of you. It doesn't need to be super transactional, I think. You know, just being very upfront and honest of like, hey, our max budget is XYZ. Can we make this work this time around? And open up the door for future of like, we're going to see how this goes. And we're totally open to, you know, renegotiating for future activations.
Yeah. And I can't remember if you said this during the chat, Rachel, or during the podcast. Either way, listen to the chat if you didn't. And then come back and listen to the answer to the question as well, too. I think that focus of relationship, that it's a human interaction not just like that transactional, like, hey, pay for posts. Like, yes, there's a world where that makes sense for like a very specific campaign. But overall, if someone's willing to negotiate and have that conversation, if you think about it, like if they have a rate card, that means that they're being approached by multiple people. A way that you can stand out as a brand is to treat them like a human being. Like, hey, help me understand what your rate is. What is it that you need? Like, is it a long-term contract that you need? Do you need more time for videos? Is that what you like to focus on? Like, let's work together. I think that's a great way to create a great brand experience. You're more likely to stand out from everybody else that's asking them for like a post and then are taking the rate that could potentially afford them. Or maybe you've just planted the seed and they come back to you. And then that's a good time to send them a gift anyways, right? Like, hey, here you go. I know we're not working together, but here you go, because you've created an experience for them too. If you don't know the ROI on your creators or partnerships, how do you even know if you should continue those relationships? So if you don't know the ROI, and to me, this question almost reads a little bit like ROI is thought of as like the revenue versus like the true return on investment. So I don't know if either one of you want to dig into like ROI. Is it just revenue? Is there more to ROI?
I think there's more to ROI. I think it truly, and that's up for you to define. And in order for you to decide whether your creators are successful, you have to first define that and then see what they're doing, or see what they're doing and then define success based on that and then see how you can grow. But you do at some point have to define what ROI is going to be in order for you to truly decide if they're being successful. If it is revenue, then you need to start tracking revenue and decide how much revenue an influencer needs to bring in order for that to be considered a successful partnership. At what point are they giving you benefit from the amount of product that they're sending, the amount of time you're spending? Yeah. And if it's one sale and that's all it is, then great. But if it's 10, then you need to know that. And you need to know if those influencers are performing. And then if not, make adjustments accordingly.
And I think oftentimes, sometimes brands don't relay those expectations. So oftentimes when it's not a paid partnership, it's kind of, you know, a little bit gray. So I think if you can be upfront and say like, you know, is it possible to tag us in a few more posts per month and on stories? Like, I think relaying those expectations so that way they can meet them rather than cutting someone before they know if they haven't performed or not. I think being really transparent on expectations for them, I think will really go a long way.
I would definitely agree. I also think that sometimes it's such an obvious thing that gets missed, defining what success is for you as a brand. That is essentially what is going to help you define whether you're getting the return on investment. Because it's true. If it is a sale, then it is a sale. Great. Then you have something to go back to, right? But if it's content and you're getting, you know, 100 pieces of content that you're repurposing, like that's a success, whether they've made a sale. But to your point, Rebecca, if you haven't taken the time to define it, then you're never going to be able to answer that question. And I really appreciated your insight, Rachel, of like, and then also let your creators know. It's good to let them in as if they are part of your team, because they are part of your team. All right. So best practices for pitching influencers when you're a small brand without any brand awareness. I love this question because this is a question that gets brought up a lot. Let's say I am a brand. I have no brand awareness. How do I get an influencer to say yes? Or how do I pitch an influencer?
I honestly, that's a hard one for me to answer because I've worked for very, you know, notable brands. That's such a humble brag. I hope that doesn't come off like inappropriate. But I think one thing that I always think about is being as like upfront with the influencer. And that starts in the subject line, right? Like making it pop. And also just being very straightforward. Like sometimes I would even just put like brand name and influencer. And I know that sounds kind of like not very personalized, but it also like think about how many emails influencers are getting throughout the day.
Yeah.
If I saw a brand in my inbox that I wasn't quite sure of, I still would click into it because I kind of want to know more. I'm curious.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be rocket science or like the most perfect subject line, but just being like really upfront, like brand, let's work with each other, something like that. And then getting into more detail in the actual email, being very visual too. I think like showing your product up front I think could go a long way.
I honestly think that's where brands should be spending a lot of their time when they're creating their program is email, tone of voice, and subject lines. You have this one shot to get in their inbox before someone clicks out or decides to reply or not. I really think it's impactful if you think of your tone of voice, how you want to approach it. You know, I tended to be really fluffy and conversational, but that may not work for some brands. If you're a science-backed brand, you know, maybe having some hyperlinks to some credible articles could be beneficial. But thinking of tone of voice and how you can stand out with that subject line, with that messaging, and for a brand that is not as well known, maybe it's a little bit of about the brand or a little couple sentences that explains like, hey, this is who we are and this is why we're cool. You got to kind of hook it up. So think about the hook and spend time there. And it's hard. I would spend weeks on emails, even, you know, after my program was built out and how I wanted to communicate because it was so important, communication.
I think one thing that I like to make sure is don't be too wordy in the email either. Try and keep it as short as you can while still getting your message across. I see a lot of brands try and put a lot of information into that first email and it gets overwhelming. Think about the influencer again, and they're looking at it on their phone. They're probably not at the desktop that we are when we're typing out the email. So it comes across much longer to them. And think about how you check your personal email. Are you like, do you check it when you're, you know, sitting at a desk, or do you check it like while you're waiting for an elevator, or like maybe you're doing something you're not supposed to be doing and checking at a red light or something like that?
But we're not promoting texting and driving.
No, we're not. But it's like checking your personal email tends to be a little bit more passive than our work email is. So trying to keep it as short and to the point as you can, while still being as conversational as possible. It sounds like a lot to ask for like 4 or 5 sentences, but come up with that, like Rachel said, that pitch, and stick to it. And you might have to adjust it, and you'll learn as people respond and stuff, you'll learn how to adjust that as needed. And as people start asking more questions about your brand, you can start kind of incorporating that more and more into that first email. And then you have multiple touch points. Once they get that answer back to you and say, yeah, I'm interested, let's talk, then you have another opportunity to provide a little bit more insight about what the brand is doing and what your message is.
Yeah, holding the cards a little bit close to your chest. And I think the key takeaway is people tend not to read, you know, us as influencer marketers, but also influencers. Like, people don't read paragraphs. We like bullet points. We like bold. We like italics. So that concise, it's a really hard skill. That concise sentence and not being wordy is really hard. So shorter is better.
Yeah. And ask a question at the end. I always signed off like,
questions.
How does this sound? Want to work together? Or would you be interested in hearing more? You know, it sounds very like email markety, but like kind of is. I would even pull in our copy editor sometimes because like, while I'm, you know, I know how to talk to influencers, if I wanted to get a little bit more creative and engage more of that hook, utilize your email marketing team or copy editors. I think that's a great resource.
Yeah, I love the questions. The questions give them something to respond to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think also not providing all the details up front, like getting, because I think if they see all the details, then there's no way to, if they're already making up a yes or no in their mind. So having that, like maybe it can be really beneficial by keeping some things for the next email.
Yeah, there are some really great just kind of email marketing hacks that kind of pose things that people would naturally say yes to as they're reading something, because then they've got the yes in mind, so that when you get to that final question, right? When you get to the final question, does this sound good? They're already saying yes because they've been mentally saying yes to. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Rachel. It is so hard to be concise. It is so much easier to be loquacious and have like an 8,000 word document to be able to express yourself. But that subject line, man, if you don't get like those anywhere from like 3 to 10 words, and 10 words is a lot, you know, there's got to be a lot of pronouns in there. Like if you don't get those right and they don't open the email, don't go straight to the body of the email that you are sending. Go to that subject line, test out those subject lines, hitting, you know, a note from Rebecca's like test, like what gets the highest open rates. And then if they're not clicking through, all right, what am I saying in there? Are they not saying yes after they open, or have they just not even opened? Lots of great advice. We've come to the end. I appreciate you guys so much. Again, you drop knowledge at the Fireside Chat. You drop knowledge here. I hope that everybody listens. and they share it with their family and friends, and everyone's listening during the holiday season, and all that good stuff. But thank you guys again so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
We had so many great questions and answers come out of our discussion on leveraging creators in this cookieless world. Authenticity and relationships are the key takeaways for me. What about you? There are humans behind how marketing is executed, as well as behind who is executing the vision. Creators as storytellers of your brand, finding the right influencers, sharing the influencers that are working well, and negotiating, we covered a lot during our conversation. Do you want to hear more? Be sure to subscribe to the Grin Gets Real podcast to get the latest episodes. And be sure to give us a rating and leave a review. I love seeing the 5 stars, no pressure. And if you're interested in watching the Fireside Chat with Rebecca, Kristen, and Rachel on living the cookieless life as marketers using creators, or you want to listen to our Brands Talking Influencer Fireside Chat series featuring brands like Able, Organifi, Trifecta, Nutribold, and so many more, visit the live events section at the grin.co website. Check out our resources and blogs while you're there for more tips, tricks, and marketing trends. And until next time, keep grinning.